You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 12. Welcome to the show today. I'm so excited today because I've got an absolutely amazing interview today, and it's with our first international guest. I'm talking to Dr. Karen Baruch Feldman, who's from New York State in America. And she's just written a book called The Grit Guide for Teens, and she's going to be talking to us all about how to help your teenagers be grittier, which will help them to achieve their goals. But before we dive into the interview, I just wanted to let you know that you've just got just over a week now to sign up for my brand new course, The Exam Success Formula, which is a course for parents and students to help your sons and daughters, the teenagers, to achieve their full academic potential. And the reason why I've put parents and students together is because when I work with students, I also spend an awful lot of time talking to their parents, which is completely understandable, because if you care profoundly about your child's education and that they're achieving their full potential, you want to be kept fully in the loop with any tutors or a coach like me or their teachers in school about how they're getting on with their goals. But I've also noticed through working in my private Facebook group for parents, that's the Supportive Parents Successful Students Facebook group, and there's a link to that in the show notes if you'd like to come and join, that there's an awful lot going on for parents alongside what's going on for students. So while the students are really stressed out about their exams or their homework or their revision or their coursework, whatever's going on for them at school, their parents are also stressed, but in a slightly different way. So I've set up this course so that not only will I be teaching the valuable skills, the kind of thing I talked about with Martin Griffin in the previous episode, the non-cognitive skills like time management and developing good habits and all that kind of thing, but we'll be really focusing on how you as a parent communicate with your teenager in a really positive way that helps you both and reduces the stress level for you both and even builds your relationship and makes it stronger through the course of this academic year and beyond. So if you'd like to know more about the course and about what we're going to cover, I've put a link in the show notes. It's called The Exam Success Formula, and you can click on the link in the show notes, or you can just Google The Exam Success Formula, or if you go to the Work With Me page on my website, lifemoreextraordinary.com, then you can click on there and you'll find a link through to the information page there. We start on the 16th of September, which is a Saturday. The first class email will go out that morning. So I'm taking registrations until the 15th at 9 p.m. at night, and then I'll send out the first class email the next morning. But there is a kind of introductory lesson that you can get going with at any point when you sign up, so it'd be a great idea to get signed up in plenty of time before the class actually starts, so that you can make sure that you're fully organised and that you can get to work on the introductory task that you will get as soon as you sign up. Okay, if you've got any questions at all about the course, any doubts, concerns, worries, anything like that, I'm really happy to answer those for you. You can email me at lucy@lifemoreextraordinary.com, or you can just leave them in the comments on the show notes for this podcast, or in the Facebook group, or even on Twitter, and I'm at Lucy C. Parsons on Twitter. But I just really would encourage you to come along and sign up for the course. It is the most affordable way to work with me, and it is also at this point in time the only way to work with me, because I am fully booked for one-to-one coaching for this term and probably actually for the rest of the year going forwards. Okay, let's get on with the show. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Karen Baruch Feldman.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Hi, I'm really well. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Fantastic. So, Karen, first of all, can you explain to us what you mean by grit? I think we've probably all got an image in our minds about what it means, but could you give us a really clear definition so we kind of can crystallise what it means?
Yeah, so my definition is based on Dr. Angela Duckworth's definition, which is grit is defined by her as having passion and perseverance for long-term goals. And what I would also add to that definition is to having this also for meaningful goals. So what does that mean in real life? It's having a goal and being able to persist on that goal that's really important to you and has meaning for you, and to persist in the long haul and be able to bounce back when the obstacles that naturally happen when you're taking on hard things happen to you. So that's my definition, I guess, of grit.
That's fantastic. That's so close to what I try to coach students, because when I work with students coaching them towards getting good grades in their exams, the first thing I always do with them is to identify a long-term goal so that they really understand why they're taking these exams, what they're studying for, what it's all leading to. And yes, grit or kind of perseverance and determination is kind of what gets them there in the end, isn't it?
Yes. And I think the thing that's kind of tricky, and I think that I'm sort of like really intrigued about, is this whole long-term nature and how our brain isn't actually so attuned to the long-term. So a lot of the strategies, and I think that you probably do this almost naturally, that I'm trying to do in this book is to get kids to really connect and make things more concrete so that they can pursue long-term goals. Because again, we have a tendency to focus on what's going to be good in the moment, especially in this world today. And I think it's like our job to maybe be creative and figure out how do we make these things more concrete, make them more attainable, and so that teens can really think that they can succeed and get these long-term goals accomplished.
Yeah, so it's very much about breaking it down, like a big goal, a big long-term goal, down into very small component parts so that you can work towards that goal in kind of little bits. Is that what you're driving at?
Yes. And also, I feel like success breeds success, so that when the patients or the students I work with in my school, or even just the kids that I worked with in terms of interviewing this book, I think that for them, when they see that they're successful in a small goal, they feel that they're willing to continue and take on harder things. One of the things I notice about myself, even in being gritty in my own life, is that when I've taken on challenging things, I'm more willing to take on more challenging things. So I think that that's really important for us to, as you said, kind of break it down, have success breed success, and have kids eventually sort of make it a habit to take on challenging things.
Yeah, and when I work with students, I'm thinking of one particular client who I worked with in particular, and she basically she had no confidence in her ability to study, and she was a university student, and just by achieving small goals, just by like getting a particular piece of work done on time and handed in and getting a halfway decent mark for it, that increased her confidence, and so she was willing to try again next time. And it was like a snowball effect. The more she did it, the more she was able to do it, and the confidence built and built and built over time, so she became more gritty as a result.
Right. And again, I think that it's sometimes different when you're working with teens than adults. I think buy-in, although I think even with adults, buy-in is key. But I think especially when you're working with someone who may not be what they want, maybe it's a parent, maybe it's a counselor, maybe it's somebody else, I think it's essential to make that buy-in. And sort of the way I've outlined the book, it's the first part of the book is helping teens get that buy-in, connected to a value, connected to a sense of purpose, connected to something so that they want to take this on. Because when we have that intrinsic motivation, we can do amazing things, all of us.
Definitely. And I think, that is definitely what separates adults from teenagers and students, isn't it? It's having that kind of that kind of personal volition. It's something that you have decided to do, whereas like with teenagers, that it's often prescribed. You have to do this, like you have to do this piece of work towards your exams, or you have to turn up to a hockey practice today, or whatever it is. And so that kind of personal choice element is taken away from them, and that can build up a level of resentment, can't it?
Yes, and I think that even more so, I think that developmentally the task of teens and young adults is to become independent. So there's almost like this natural conflict when we, as the grown-ups, keep telling them things to do. So I think that we have to be really sensitive and really careful to that. And I think as much as we can give teens and young adults choice and have them feel like they're in leadership positions, we are sort of using that natural thing that we're born with to become independent at this stage of our lives and using it to work with us again instead of what we often do, which is really try to control teens and manage teens and bulldoze teens. I think that the more successful interventions you'll see are more nudgy and stealthy and allow teens to have more leadership roles.
That's absolutely fascinating. I think I talked about in one of the very early podcast episodes, I think it was episode number two, I talked about how, you have this as a parent, you have a baby, and it like through to from the baby's infancy through to adulthood, it's a continuous process for the parent of letting go, letting go, letting go. And that can often be quite difficult for parents, can't it? To like give their child the independence they need to become this independent, fully functioning adult human being. And so using these kind of stealthy methods that you kind of advocate in your book kind of through the back door, then that's an interesting way of going about it, isn't it?
Yes, and I think we have to understand why it is hard for parents because, again, I think, it's sort of like the job keeps changing. And we could all imagine if we all had any job that we had, like, if we had a job and working, let's say, in my school, or if you work in an office, you can imagine if your boss kept just changing the job on you and what the tasks are, it can be really challenging. And what's good for a younger child isn't always good for an older child. So I think it can be tough. And I also think that sometimes as teens, they say, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems. I think sometimes the stakes almost feel higher. So it can be really, I think, challenging. And I think that parents need to almost be very metacognitive and realize that this is challenging. This is a challenge for them. They need grit to do this, but that if they do, they will get the product that they're really looking for.
Definitely. Okay. So, reading your book, it was really clear to me that it's possible to be gritty in all sorts of different areas of life. So, we've kind of talked about academic studies so far, but kind of what are all the different areas of life that you break down in the book into, what are the areas that people can be gritty in?
Right. So I break this down into different domains. I was very influenced actually by Walter Mischel. Walter Mischel, I had the pleasure of, I went to Barnard, which is part of Columbia University, and I was able to take this small graduate class with him. And, Walter Mischel obviously is very famous for his marshmallow study. But the other thing he's also really famous, and I remember, and I don't remember that much back from my college days, that he spoke about is that people are different in different situations. And that's really true also about grit. You can be very gritty in one domain and not so much in the other. So what I thought would be really interesting is to sort of break it down into these different domains. So we talked about academic. The other area that I sort of ask teens to sort of focus on or ask them if they're interested in building their grit is in the social domain, in health and wellness, in extracurricular and emotional grit. And I do think that it's sort of unique about my book is that I do break it down into these domains. And my goal also in doing that is for them to learn from their strengths. So let's say, for example, and I had this personally about myself, and sort of if you read my book, you see this kind of coming through, is that for me, academics have always been an area that I've had strength. It's something that I've always really felt is important. I felt that the costs were low. I felt my likelihood of success was high. But in terms of my wellness, not so much. I was sort of exercising, but sometimes sticking to the food plan that I wanted wasn't always successful. So for me, I really tried, and this is sort of how I even came to this work, to apply what I was doing in terms of my academic success. How could I think about this? How can I engage in behavior? How do I get the support so that I can do what I'm doing in my strength in the area that I want to grow? And that's sort of like the flavor and the direction that I take in the book is to learn from our strengths, And not only just focus on the negative, but again, focus on our strengths and use that information to guide where we want to grow.
That's really interesting because I think very much like you, I was always really strong academically and so ridiculously determined to achieve my goals that, you know, I would not compromise in any way to achieve what I wanted to achieve. But when it came to a cake being on the table, I could not refuse.
And yes.
Yeah. And you wrote some similar things about yourself in the book. And
right.
What I really wondered is, is it possible to run out of willpower? Because I kind of equate grit a bit in my head with willpower. You know, is it possible to have a finite amount of willpower? Or can you always be growing it?
Well, I think that there is, you know, Roy Boymeister is, you know, talks a lot about willpower and talks about how willpower is a limited resource, that mm-hmm. when we use willpower, and he has a number of studies, and it's a little bit more controversial now in the field about exactly, you know, if it is a limited resource. It used to be very clear that people believe this. It's sort of, people are sort of talking about it in the academic world about this notion. But I think everyone would agree that just using willpower is the most ineffective strategy in terms of self-control, mm-hmm. and that where we are going to be much more successful is if we actually use other strategies. So like in terms of like Walter Mischel's work, like when those kids I alluded to before were able to think about the marshmallow, and I hope you understand what I'm saying. Walter Mischel was very famous for this marshmallow study where he offered preschool students, or preschool children, I wouldn't say they're students, one marshmallow now or two marshmallows later. And what he found was that some of the kids were able to wait, and how they were able to wait were that they actually thought about the marshmallows differently, or that they distracted themselves, or they didn't look at the marshmallows. So kind of going back to our cake and my cookie issues as well, yeah. I'm going to be much more successful if I don't use willpower. Like if I don't have the most delicious cookies that I like in front of me in the kitchen when I've had a hard day, that is going to be a much more effective strategy to not go into the kitchen than to think that, oh, I could just sit in the kitchen with the smell of the cookies going and have willpower. So I think that that's really important. Actually, I just had a session yesterday with a youngster, and I don't know, there's this big rave now going on in the States about slime. I don't know if you know about slime.
Oh, I haven't heard about that, no.
Oh, there's this putty thing that these kids love playing with. And so one of the youngsters that was here in a session, she wanted to play with the slime, and that was fine. And we said she could play with the slime, but at a certain point, the slime needed to go away. And again, we talked about the self-control strategy, like keeping the slime really near her was not going to be so effective. It's going to be that she's going to have to be using willpower. Whereas if I put the slime away somewhere in a place where she couldn't even see it, she was going to be more effective. And that's some of the things. And again, I work in a school. I work with students. Like, again, if you're going to be distracted by the little stuff in your desk, then put those things further away. Then think that you can have it there and just sort of willpower yourself not to touch it.
Yeah, definitely. So this really leads into the question I was going to ask you about how can teens develop gritty behavior? And I know you've got various different kind of pillars, if you like, that you can use, a bit like the ones you've just been talking about, that teens can use to develop their gritty behaviour. Do you want to run us through those? I'm thinking of SMART goals and practice and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think, again, that we all, like, again, I think we said before, like, I think you need to have first the right mindset. You have to have that passion. You have to have commitment. You have to have that optimism. But that's not enough. I think, like you're saying now, we have to also take that mindset and make it into behavior. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it all starts with goals. We need to, again, like we said at the beginning, how do we take something long-term and make it more concrete? How do we bring the future into the present? Because, again, the brain has a preference for now. And so a lot of the things that we're doing is helping that future behavior become the now behavior. So for example, making a concrete goal that you're working on and having that goal front and center of your mind. So not like just having a goal and like forgetting about it, but every day, like reading about what are the advantages of that goal and then committing to that goal and having an accountability partner. I know, again, in my school, and recently I actually just decided to take on the New York Marathon. I've committed. I've told people. I'm now telling you this.
Wow.
This makes it more that I have to do it, right?
Yeah.
I can't kind of back out. And so when the kids in my school or teens or other people take on a goal and they let other people know, they really are committing to it. And that accountability and that support also is really essential. The other thing you sort of talked about is practice and what kind of practice is most effective. And Anders Ericsson is the leading expert on deliberate practice, a type of practice which isn't that fun, by the way, but it really hones in on your weakness, and you keep on working on your weakness, and you visualize what it is that you need to work on, and you work on that really in a very like narrow way. You know, again, our brains, we always are now multitasking. So this deliberate practice is very different from that. It's staying with one area and one area of weakness until it's sort of mastered. You know, he prescribes sort of doing this like for 15 minutes because it can be really tough to do this for longer. But things like deliberate practice. And there's also, I'm not sure if you're familiar, there's this thing called WHOOP. Do you know how to WHOOP?
I've heard of that. explain it again, though, for our listeners, please.
Yeah, so WHOOP. I'm a big fan of WHOOP. It's by Dr. Gabrielle Attingen. She is out of NYU, and she talks about how there was this notion, I don't know if it was popular in England, about, you know, if you wish it, it will happen. It was like this sort of like, you know, you make this sort of vision board. Mm-hmm. And what she found was that actually does kind of like not really effective. It is effective to imagine your goals and to think about them. But if you don't think about what is the obstacle that's getting in your way, then you're not going to be successful. So she has, if people, she's worked with lots of kids and grownups, and she's found that when people take on goals and they WHOOP, which is they think about what their wish is, that's the W, mm-hmm. and then the O, the outcome for their wish.
Yeah.
And then they mentally contrast that with the obstacle and then making an if-then plan. People are really successful at accomplishing their goals. So using WHOOP is an effective strategy.
So the P is plan, is it, on that?
Plan, yes. Yeah, and yeah. What she likes is making people have it as an if-then plan. So let's say my wish is to, for example, for me, and you know, Sir Anthony Seldon is actually had this conversation with me about this. I don't know if you're familiar with him from
yes, yeah,
from
I know of him. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So this is a shout out to him because we had this conversation. So my wish, let's say, for example, is not to eat cookies after 9. And then I would imagine what all that outcome, why would that be so awesome for me if that would happen? And then I need to mentally contrast that and think, what is the obstacle that's getting in the way? So to be quite honest, the obstacle that gets in the way is that somehow after all my patience and I'm done working at 9 o'clock, I sort of mosey on into the kitchen. And I think this time I'm not going to be affected by all the sweets in my cabinet. So that's the obstacle. So then I have to make a plan. So if I start to want to mosey on into the kitchen, my plan will be that I will mosey on into my bedroom, which is further away from that. So I make a plan that's sort of contingent on that feeling that what I want to do and make a plan for that. So that's how WHOOP in sort of a nutshell in kind of works. It's really trying to imagine what you want and then mentally contrast and think about that obstacle and plan for that obstacle.
Yeah.
Because again, the more we plan and the more we're thoughtful and metacognitive and mindful, the more we're going to be successful.
Definitely. So what I just want to run through this all with a little bit more of a kind of concrete example. I'm going to use myself just
okay.
because I can't think of anything better.
Yes.
But my goal when I was a student at school was that I wanted to study at Cambridge University. And I knew mm-hmm. in order to do that, I needed the top-notch exam grade. So I set myself the goal of getting straight A's. And through practice, so I, you know, practiced exam papers, I marked them, I checked to see where I was going wrong and worked on my areas of weakness, I was able to kind of keep it, work towards that, my goal, but I kept that goal always front and center of my mind. Like I never, ever forgot it. And if anything difficult came my way or, you know, an obstacle came my way, like I remember once I was working on my coursework and I hadn't saved it, and then the computer crashed And I lost all my work. And I
Oh.
remember lying, kicking, screaming on the floor just out of frustration because I'd done so much and it was all gone. But I had picked myself up and I said, right, I've just got to get on with this now because if I want to achieve my goal, I've just got to do it all over again. So, I dealt with obstacles in that kind of strong-minded way. I think the other thing that you talk about a bit is habit formation, and that's something I talk an awful lot about with my students. And do you want to take that and talk about how habits are the foundation of good be of achieving difficult goals?
Yeah, so I think like habits are, again, going back to the whole notion about willpower being sort of limited, is that habits are a way to sort of bypass the challenges that are associated with willpower. So when something becomes a habit, so for example, I wake up, I assume you do as well, we wake up, brush our teeth, it's a habit. I'm not using willpower to do that because it's just a habit. And so as we can encourage teens to make this gritty behavior a habit, it becomes much more natural and more automatic and almost unconscious process. So, for example, like I know you used your example, like I felt the same way about writing my first book. So it was a lot of work. There were definitely obstacles along the way, but I had a habit of getting up every morning, not every morning, but many mornings at 5 o'clock in the morning and to write. And that became a habit. That's not a thing I used to always do. I was used to be known for sleeping in late, but that is not true anymore. So it becomes this habit, and then it becomes something that it just becomes a routine and it doesn't become as much of an obstacle. So I think, if we, and the other thing, like for example, that's like a habit, for me, if I, certain classes or certain things I do at the gym, if I put them in my schedule and I have that as a habit and part of routine, it just becomes part of our schedule. We sometimes, again, I don't think we realize a lot of things that we do on automatic. And if we can get more gritty behavior to be more automatic, it becomes easier, I think people are ultimately more successful.
Definitely. So a habit that I've had for a really long time is always, always, always having a snack in the middle of the morning. And I'm trying to break that habit at the moment. And at the moment, it's really hard because I'm not used to it. I'm trying to break the habit of a lifetime. But actually, it gets easier as the days go by. And as I build up a track record, I can kind of say to myself, well, you didn't have to have one yesterday. There's no reason why you should need one today. And, I can play those mental tricks with myself, like talk myself into carrying on with the good habit until it becomes something that is truly a habit that happens on automatic pilot. I think the other thing I'd like to say about habit formation is about kind of work routines or study routines that students might have at school. Like for me, when I was in my final 2 years at school studying for my A levels, I used to come home from school, I'd sit with my mum, have a cup of tea and a piece of cake, and then I would go upstairs at 4:30. And literally every single afternoon, I would go upstairs at 4:30 and I would start studying. And I would study till 6:30, and then I would have my evening meal with my family, and then I would go back upstairs from 7 till 9 and study again. And it was that habit, and it was literally totally entrenched. I never questioned it. I just got on with it. And that kind of routine and level of effort is what enabled me to get the grades to get into Cambridge. So if you can build those habits which you no longer question, that is what makes you successful, isn't it?
Yes, and I also think one of the things that you did, or other good things that you did, is that you first of all used what I call no choice. You made it like a red line. We do better when things are no choice. Like for example, I'm kosher. Like I don't eat lobster. I don't eat meat with milk. It's not a choice. Like so, when I go to a restaurant, I see a lobster. It's not an option. Or it's like if I go to a jewelry store and I don't have money for a jewelry, I'm not going to steal that. It's just not a choice. So I think if we can make things like you said, it's like not a choice. 4:30, I'm going upstairs. Our brain, it's easier for us to process things. Sometimes I think we as human beings think, let me think about this. Let me think about the pros and the cons of coming up at 4:30. But once we've already gone in that dance, we're in a little bit of a downward spiral. So I think, again, if we could say no choice, like the other night, I had a patient who is working at staying in their bed. You know, they sometimes sneak into their parents' bed later on. And I was saying to him, you need to make this a habit. You need to make it no choice. No choice that those feet go down onto the floor. That's how you have to think about it. And you also, the more you stay in your bed, the more you're going to have that experience that that's where your body sleeps. And then that is going to be your new normal. Because again, think about it. When you're starting a new habit, there's so much old information, like this is the way you should be doing things. You know, we do so many things with habits. You know, you put on your shoe, you put your right on, your left. You don't think about that. And so the best way to change behavior is introducing new behavior. And so that's why at the beginning, when you make habits, they're so hard, because you have a lot of history in your body, like muscle memory, of doing things differently. And so you, what you're doing is, when you're making a new habit, you're overriding that, and it sometimes takes some time.
Yeah, I've heard this being talked about as crowding things out, particularly in response in to do with healthy eating. So one of the ways I've tried to break the cake habit is by replacing it with fruit. So instead of eating a piece of cake, I eat a piece of fruit. And that is effectively crowding it out, because once you've had the piece of fruit, you're full and you no longer need to eat. So you won't have that piece of cake. I just wanted to go back to social media and how that is linked to this kind of crowding out idea and self-control. Because I know social media is a huge problem for many, many teenagers, and, you know, how it distracts them from their studies or whatever other grit goals they might be working towards. So could you talk us through the example of social media and how they could break the bad habits they might have there?
So I think that social media has, there's like a host of issues with social media. And that it really is very addictive, social media. The way it's sort of set up is that it kind of, like, the more you do, the more you want to do it. And I even see that in myself, like, over the years, like, you know, things like Facebook, and the more I spend time doing it, the more I've sort of start doing it. So I think, like, again, I think first of all, teens need to know that there's a little bit of an addictive element to doing this. So I think, again, in terms of having clear rules or clear habits about when people engage, you know, not making it so that it's also that's so available, like there's pop-ups or, and especially in terms of studying, if they can go to a place where social media is not going to sort of pop up on them, I think that they're going to be more successful than think that they can keep all their devices in front of them and not be distracted by that. So I know that sometimes some of the teens have told me that that's really helpful, that they'll go to the library, they'll turn off devices, they'll put it away, so that they don't kind of get influenced. And the other thing with social media, and I don't know if this is what you were sort of also interested in, is that I do think that it's affecting a lot of teens in terms of social anxiety. Because one of the areas that I'm sort of interested in is helping teens feel more socially comfortable. And what I'm seeing in my practice is a huge increase in, like, social anxiety and feeling good enough about themselves. You know, people, when they post, they put rainbows and unicorns, and they've taken 7,000 selfies, but they put one on and it's the perfect picture. And it's making lots of teens feel like really that they're missing out and that they're inferior. And so I do think that that stuff can also be really not helpful to teens in large doses in terms of that whole social anxiety.
Okay, so that's interesting. I wonder if you could talk us through kind of how a teen, like using your workbook maybe to work through this, could use or develop their grit as a way to combat that social anxiety.
So I think that, yeah, again, so first of all, the first way I guess they would use the workbook is, I mean, the thing is that I want them to connect to whatever grit goal that they're going to take on. Mm-hmm. So the way the workbook starts is to sort of, you know, like kind of take a little survey and see where you want to grow your grit. So the first thing would be that the teen themselves, like we were saying with the social grit, if that's the example we're going to use, that they would really want to, that they would see why this is important to them. They would see how their likelihood of success could be high depending on the tools that they're going to be using here, how the cost might be lowered for them. And so once they've committed and they've decided that that's what they want to work on, then they would work on having the right mindset. How do they think about social exchanges in a more optimistic way. A lot of people, one of the things that I really think is really helpful for my patients, and I've heard when I give workshops, is not falling into these problematic P's. These P's which count, as Marty Seligman talks about, is taking things personally, making it pervasive, and making it permanent. So when you have a social exchange, or you come into like freshman year of school and you go to orientation and somebody doesn't talk to you, do you take it personally? Do you make it pervasive? Do you say that this is permanent, it's going to always be this way? Or instead, do you say, you know what, lots of kids, when they come to freshman orientation, they feel at times uncomfortable, and that this is a normal problem. And that just because I'm having an issue right now doesn't mean that tomorrow I'm going to have an issue. And even if I'm feeling uncomfortable right now, I know that over time that maybe I can grow from this, or a way to think about it. So having that mindset about thinking about those social exchanges in a way that will inspire teens to put themselves out. Because what I'm noticing is that in the kids that are socially anxious, they want sometimes that interaction, but they're sending out vibes to the world like, do not talk to me. I am uncomfortable. And so that they also need to not only have that mindset, they also have to engage in that behavior. So smiling at people, greeting people, making it their business that even if they're feeling uncomfortable, that's going back to that deliberate practice, that they will take on this weakness and put themselves out there so that they can meet people and grow this if that's something that they want to do. And ultimately, have it be a habit that they're engaging in social exchanges, because for many kids who are maybe not socially gritty, they don't have that habit. They come into a room and they sort of step back, and that's their habit. So ultimately, making that a habit. And then the other thing that I do want to say that is that I don't believe this work is to be done only alone, and that everyone I know who's grown their grit, they have a grit team. They have that support. So finding your cheerleader, finding your accountability partner, finding your counselor, but doing this together so that when things are hard, you have somebody to bounce ideas off and kind of get that validation.
Yeah. So can parents be a good kind of accountability partner within that context of helping their teenagers to develop grit in a particular area of their lives?
I think that they can potentially, but I think sometimes what will happen, and it's out of love often, is that parents often will get anxious when they see their teen is struggling. And if they can, you know, and then we have these things called mirror neurons, which are these neurons that connect us with other people. So like the teen is anxious and the parent is anxious and they're sort of bouncing off of each other.
Yeah.
But I think if parents can kind of take that step back and remember that their job is to sort of launch their teen and to give them the skills and not do the skills for them, I do think that parents can be a terrific resource for teens in terms of growing their grit. And I think also parents can be a terrific role model and sharing with their teens things that were hard for them. I think there's a thing called an iceberg illusion, which is that you often see successful people and you just see their success. You don't see all the hard work. Teens often see their parents, they're accomplished. They don't see all that hard work. They look at you, let's say, for example, and they see that you have all these accomplishments, but you're sharing with me and this podcast about what you did, but that's not always the case. And so I think when parents can share their stories about how they got to where they are and be really explicit about that, I think that that can be really helpful for teens. Mm-hmm. I had a really interesting thing. In my school, we set grit goals with the fifth graders, and some of them wanted to get more gritty in terms of improving their math skills. And so what I did was I asked some of the students who were sort of identified as the strong math students, and I think the other students were very surprised that the strong math students were using lots of strategies to be strong math students. Mm-hmm. It wasn't magic. And I think it was incredibly helpful to the other students to see that there was a whole iceberg there. It wasn't just this top that's helping these kids really do well.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because in the previous podcast that it's going, it's the week before's podcast, I had a discussion with somebody else about something very similar, that the high achieving students, it's never just on kind of innate talent, you know, mm-hmm. there's always stuff going on behind the scenes, and it's just about uncovering what that is so that the other people who may be struggling a little bit more can actually see the successful strategies that, you know, the successful students are using.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. In the book, you talk a bit about how we all have two minds and how understanding these better will help us to become grittier. Can you explain that a bit more for us, please?
Yeah, so I have been sort of interested in Kahneman's work about think fast, think slow, about the more system one, system two type of thinking, which is like this more automatic thinking versus this more deliberate, more cognitive, thoughtful type of thinking. And also Walter Mischel talks about hot and cool thinking. And lots of people describe, you know, this type of duality that we have within us. So I think we all feel that there's part of us that sometimes can be overtaken by what's going to feel good in the moment versus what's going to be good in the long term.
Like and eating that cookie. Like eating that cookie or that piece of cake.
Yes, but it's really true because we all know, like, what if we, you know, it's the cookie, it's the sleeping in the bed, it's the making friends, it's everything. It's, you know, going to the gym or it's anything like that we want to take on. There is often that kind of duality within ourselves. And I think it's important to us to understand that we do have these two minds. And I think that the question is, how do we then, knowing that we often have this two ways of thinking about things, we access that more long-term, more mindful self. Mm-hmm. And one of the strategies I talk about in the book, and sometimes I think people will be like, mindfulness? Why is mindfulness in a book about grit? Mm-hmm. But engaging in meditation and mindfulness is really building that more long-term, more metacognitive, more mindful part of ourselves, that ability to pause and just to be reflective instead of reactive, and to be able to make that decision. Like, yes, I may want that cookie, but is that really going to be good in the long run? And ultimately, I may say to myself, you know what? It's not, because I don't want to be accused of being a total killjoy here. That, you know, there's no room for cookies. But the point is that I want teens to be in charge of that instead of that feeling being in charge of them.
Yes, definitely. And yeah, and I think that's the secret to all of this, really, isn't it? It's learning to be in control of your own destiny, isn't it? And not being taken off track by the cookie or by the tempting party when you should be studying, or by the social media when you should be doing your music practice, or any of those kind of things. It's about making those very, very mindful decisions, moment by moment by moment, about, are you working towards that long-term grit goal, or are you just going to be happy in the moment?
Right.
Yeah.
And again, and what I try to do in this workbook is to take the science that's out there, a lot of, again, behavioral economics, cognitive behavioral theory, positive psychology theory, and sort of loop that in so that we're using research that is out there now about how we can do this. Because, again, we do have a bias towards the moment, you know, when there's a lot of this thing called, you know, behavioral economics experiments that show that people will make a preference of taking something less, you know, less expense, like, you know, less money if it's now versus waiting for something later. So our brains work in that way. We can't fight our brains. We can understand how our brains are, and then we can use that to make better decisions. So again, the things like you did, like making habits, making things concrete, having an advantage card, reading every day what it is that you, why this thing is important. You have to bring this goal into the forefront, as opposed to just thinking, oh, somehow I'm gonna like wake up and just like, you know, get into Cambridge, you know?
Yeah,
that doesn't happen, you know?
Yeah, you have to have a strategic plan to make difficult things like that happen. I think it's really interesting. I was reading the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill recently. Mm-hmm. And one of his things about, you know, one of the, what the amazing entrepreneurs in kind of the 1920s and 1900s in America did was they always wrote down their goals when they woke up in the morning and when they went to sleep at night. And I think that's so powerful. Like, if it's the first thing you think about in the morning, the last thing you think about when you go to sleep at night, that's keeping it front and center, and it stops you from getting distracted by all the different things that pop up on a daily basis. I think another similar thing is when people are advised to write down their goals for the day or the things they want to achieve that day first thing in the morning. And I hear a lot of entrepreneurs say, don't check your email for the first hour of the day. So you actually get something done in that time before you allow distractions into your life. And I think all these things can be transferred to how teenagers can achieve their grit goals, can't they?
Yes. And I think that, again, yeah, I think even more so today, because I think our brains, and I think teens especially, brains are changing. I think that all this, everything is very fast, you know. Mm. You know, people don't have to wait anymore. There's a restaurant that just opened up near me, and the way it works now is like you go on, you have an app, and you put your food in, and then you go and you pick it up. Like, so I think my children will tell their children that, do you know, once upon a time, you used to go to a restaurant and you would order this food and you would wait.
You'd sit there for like 20 minutes.
Really? That's how it works? You didn't just like put in your order and show up and like the food is sitting on the table? So I think that we are moving in that direction. Everything is just like, if people have to wait a few seconds on with their cart, you know, online shopping, people will move on. So we have to realize that our brains are reacting to all these changes. And so there's so much pull for short term and immediate and what's grabbing your attention. And so I think even more so, this is, I think, why people are so interested in this conversation about grit and long-term goals, because I think it's almost a counterbalance to the world that we're living, and that we really need to be mindful about this, because our brains are really being, you know, changed as a reaction to the, you know, and I think the genie's out of the bottle. Like, I'd like it that, you know, that maybe we could slow it down a little bit, but I'm not so optimistic about that. So I think that we really do need to think about, how do we counterbalance that?
So do you think our brains are actually changing evolutionarily, or are our brains being changed by the experiences that we have in our lives of this kind of can't wait culture?
I mean, I'm not like, this is not the area of expertise or my area of research, but what I read is we have, you know, an attention span maybe of a goldfish. Like, I don't know that, I don't think that that has always been the case. And I just even see for myself, and I just know that there about that muscle memory. It's like what you do wires together, fires together. And so, like, if you just don't ever have that experience of waiting, then when you do need to wait, obviously it's going to be, I think, much more challenging to you. If you know, there have been studies where people have come from a culture where waiting or things are more part of that culture, and I think it's easier for them to engage in long-term behavior. So I think it's naive to think that we're not being affected by the culture of everything being so fast and so immediate.
So do you think parents can help their children to develop more of a long-term attitude by kind of maybe delaying the point at which children have smartphones and have access to social media and that kind of thing? Or do you think that's just fruitless within the culture that we live in?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting. This professor from Dr. Alter from NYU also wrote a book about social media, and it's called Irresistible. And in the book, he talks about how all these people from Silicon Valley who have created these programs are not allowing their children to have devices and purposely picking schools that don't have technology, which I think is kind of interesting. Right. And so I think that there is a little bit of a balance. I think parents need to be aware that these things can be addictive. I think it's really hard when every single person in your school, you know, has a smartphone at a certain age and you're the only person who doesn't. I think that really is a really hard thing to ask kids to do. I mean, kids at that age, especially, you know, middle school or end of elementary school, that's sort of where people are getting these devices in America or in my area. It's really hard. They all want to be the same. So I do think that parents do need to have limitations and to have conversations about this, because my other experience with these things is that kids do really stupid things with these phones and devices, and they don't really get it. They, you know, they think Snapchat is just a moment in time. Even though it can be, you know,
you can take screenshots.
You can take a picture of it. You can do this. And I think that they just don't, like, developmentally really understand. So I think that parents really need to guide and to realize that these are really powerful things. And I don't think that young kids and even teenagers really understand them and that they have to be used responsibly. And there needs to be some limits. I think, you know, and I think that, again, like with parents, I think it's easier to set those limits when kids are younger. It's hard, like, again, like kind of when the genie is out of the bottle to like kind of pull it back.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, it's about consistency of behavior. And that's something that I talked about in one of the earlier episodes with Anne Goldsmith. I'll put a link to that in the show notes about how to manage behavior. Okay, so a couple more questions before we finish. Lots of students come to me because they're trapped in a fixed mindset about their abilities to study. So they think they're terrible at it, that they're not clever enough, or that everyone else is always going to be better than them. How do you advise teens to overcome those thinking traps? And maybe you'd just like to explain a little bit about what a fixed mindset is as well for the people who haven't come across that term before.
Right. So the notion of fixed and the opposite of growth mindset comes from Dr. Carol Dweck's work. And, you know, she's done research to demonstrate that when you have this idea that your mind can grow and change from challenge, that you're willing and you're able and you are able, and that the brain actually does change when we take on hard things, as opposed to thinking that I have a certain level of skills and that's all that I can do. And I actually feel this notion of growth and fixed mindset has been really powerful in the work that I've done in my school and also with the teens. And when kids can really hold on to that and teens can hold on to that, I think it makes a very statistical difference in the way that their willingness to kind of take on challenging things and actually accomplish higher levels of greatness. So, for example, if somebody, you know, has a challenge, let's say, or they don't see themselves as a math student, instead of saying that I'm not good at calculus, it's like, I'm not good at calculus yet.
Yeah.
And to say, and the fact is what happens is that these things are a recursive process. What happens often, let's just say with math, for example, is that if somebody thinks that they have a certain level of skills and they don't have that level that they think that they should, they disengage with the material. And then the act of disengaging doesn't allow them the practice that other people who think that they have the skills are doing. Mm-hmm. And then as a result, their math skills keep dropping and dropping. So what I would encourage everybody, and it has been found in the research, is that even when something's hard, I think that instead that they need to reframe it and say, wow, this is challenging. My teacher must believe that I can do this, and that means that my brain is growing. And in the challenge is where there is real growth. Yeah. And I think that I know from my own experience, sometimes like when I would be writing this book or something, or even in other areas of my life, sometimes even though I don't like going through the challenge, I know that I needed that challenge to make the movement that I really needed. And that sometimes in that challenge is where there's real change and development.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that's a kind of message. And I've actually seen teens, and I think it really resonates with kids and teens, and it's something that they definitely can learn and can change in terms of the way they think about things.
Yeah, definitely. It's such a powerful thing. I actually did a blog post, which Carol Dweck's TED Talk, the video of that is embedded in it, all about growth mindset and the power of not yet. And I'll link to that in the show notes so that parents can go and find out a little bit more about that if they're interested. But that kind of feeling of kind of expansion that you get when you do something difficult and you finally accomplish it, it's such an amazing feeling. And I try, you know, I'm always trying to convey to students how powerful it is and what a feeling, you know, it's the best feeling ever, I think, when you've accomplished something that was difficult and you can almost feel the new like neural connections growing in your brain.
I love right. And I also think though, and I think I even say this in the workbook, I think that sometimes when you're having an obstacle, I think it's important to say like it does sometimes feel yucky. Like I mean, nobody likes to struggle. Like there's something inherent in us like that doesn't like that necessarily that experience. But if you can reframe it, you take some of the edge off, and sometimes if you really can plow through it, you sometimes have to hit those challenges to get to the next level. I know that in Dr. Duckworth, when she talks about grit, she talks about people who in terms of their practice, and what she sort of has sort of outlined is that when people engage in activities, that we all sort of hit this natural plateau, but what happens for many people is that they then quit. But what happens is for people who really become experts is that they sort of go through that plateau. They figure it out. They find that hone in and that weakness, and they plow through. So there's no, like, secret, like, I think that some kids feel like there's, like, the secret wand that has sort of hit some people and not others. And that's really not what this really is about. And that's what I really believe, that, yes, you know, talent and having some skills, you know, are important. But if we really are looking at people who are successful, they are very gritty. They do a lot of effort and a lot of practice, and they stick with things even when they're hard.
Yeah. So I just want to throw in an example there of that kind of thing from my own life. So when I did get into Cambridge in the first year, it was the kind of first time I really had fun, to be honest. And I spent that first year having a lot of fun. And at the end of the year, my exam results came back and I got a 2-2. And I wasn't best pleased with that. So the next year, when I went back for my second year, I was very much like, okay, 2-2 is not good enough. I want to get a 2-1 overall. And what do I need to achieve that? And I really pushed myself over that plateau, over that barrier, and really explored what I needed to do to get that 2-1. And I got the 2-1 in the second year and again in the third year. So I was able to do that. But I started that experience at Cambridge probably at the least successful ebb of my entire academic life. But, you know, I learned how to overcome that.
Yes, and I think that that sometimes happens for college students. Actually, Daniel Lerner, I don't know if you are familiar with this book. He wrote this book, You Thrive. He has a class, Positive Psychology, that's like one of the most popular classes also at NYU. And he talks about, you know, how to thrive in college. And a lot of students, especially if they go to very successful schools like Cambridge, you know, they're now not the big fish.
No.
They're the little fish with all the other fish, you
it's
know,
very
there.
Common.
And
yeah.
It can be very daunting. And I think that it can be very easy to, you know, it didn't sound like that happened to you, but it can be easy to see this as really daunting. And so I think that, you know, if you could be aware that it can be challenging at the beginning to see those challenges as opportunities and not as sort of setbacks, I think it can be really important for students. And there's like these very simple, like, brief interventions where they tell students, a lot of times this happens with students, minority students, who the first time coming to school, that they come to college and it can be overwhelming. And just telling students simply that, you know what, lots of students sort of struggle,
yeah,
especially with the transition at the beginning, can be a huge intervention, a simple intervention that counselors and parents can share. So that's like one simple thing that people can let new students who are going into university know.
Okay, yeah, that's really helpful. And I know when I was at Cambridge that loads of people had that problem, that they'd been the best at their school and then they were suddenly thrown in and they were average, if not weak, compared to their peers. And that was a massive problem in kind of self-identity, really, for an awful lot of people there. Okay, I've got one last main question before we start to wrap up, Karen. So this question, it's not covered in the book, I don't think, because I've almost finished it, but not quite. is it possible to be too gritty? So the reason I ask this is because I know when I was at school, my mum thought I was almost too determined to achieve my academic goals. And that, you know, can you basically be blinded by your goals? And that can that come with a cost, I suppose, is the question.
I do think that's a really good question. I think that you can sort of be blinded by your goals. I think that for me, what I always try to think about grit is that I like Carolyn Miller just wrote also a book recently, Getting Grit, that she talks about authentic grit. I like the notion of purpose with grit, which is that when you're engaging in activities that are not only important for yourself and other people, I feel like you're also in the right direction. I think sometimes, and I see this with myself and sometimes with my kids, like I can be very gritty. Sometimes gritty and having empathy can be sort of the counterbalance of each other. Like you can be like, just suck it up and just do it and be like that around other people. And I think that can be a problem. So I think when you have more of this notion that you are doing this not only for yourself, but for other people, I think you're often on the right track. And I think in life, like everything else, there's that balance. Just like we said, there's this long term, there's a short term. I don't think that everybody always needs to be about the long term and their goals. I think that there's needs to be room for more of that, you know, short term part of us to come out as well. So for me, it's about balance, about purpose, and being like thoughtful about what your choices are.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the thing that I'm learning, I'm still learning this lesson through my life, that actually you use the word empathy. And I think having self-empathy when you're trying to achieve something difficult and kind of recognizing when maybe emotionally or physically you're pushing yourself too hard, that's really important. And, you know, sometimes the people around you can see that before you can see it yourself. And so actually have listen to the people who care about you most when they're saying, well, hold on a minute, maybe you need to go to bed a bit earlier tonight, or maybe you just need to have a day off, or, you know, whatever, things like that.
Yes. And that goes back to what I had said, that I feel like in terms of what I see, how do people or how do teens be gritty? You need that mindset, you need the behavior, but you need that team. And that's like those people around you who can kind of give you that perspective and give you that support and sort of help you maintain that balance. I think that that's really important.
Yeah, definitely. So we're just going to wrap up now, Karen, but is there anything else that you think parents ought to know about help developing grit in their teens before we finish off?
I think we really covered it. This has been a total pleasure. I mean, my whole hope with writing this book is to inspire other people, other teens to be gritty. One of the things that I'm doing is that I'm getting for this whole, you know, with the book launch is to having teens be directly involved. I made a book trailer with teens. I've made videos with teens because, again, back to what we started with originally, I feel like when teens can share other stories with teens, that's a very empowerful message. So I would just encourage people to look at the videos, share the videos. And I, again, my hope and the whole reason I'm doing this is I hope they have a, you know, a sense of purpose. I'm doing this obviously for, I feel passionate about this, but I also really do want to inspire people. I dedicated this book to my dad, who was really gritty. He, you know, was in Romania during the time of the war and then went to Israel and then came here. And I just feel like if I can, you know, share like what I've learned from him, that also like really inspires me. So I really thank you for this opportunity to cross waters and to be heard in the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, it's brilliant to be able to welcome you onto the show. So just to finish off, where can people find the book? What's the book called? And where can they connect with you if they want to after the show is over?
So the book is called The Grit Guide for Teens, and the full name is The Grit Guide for Teens, a workbook to help you build perseverance, self-control, and a growth mindset. It is available. The best thing to do is, if they want, is to, you can go to my website, which is drbaruchfeldman.com. Mm-hmm. And there is a listing of then all the places where the book can be purchased. I do know it's available on Amazon in the UK.
It is. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes, both the page on your website and to the book on Amazon UK for anybody who wants to use those.
Yeah. And then I do have also a YouTube channel that I was saying about with the videos. It's under The Grit Guide for Teens. That's the way they can find the YouTube channel. And I also have a Facebook page called The Grit Guide for Teens. And the videos and anything about the book and blogs and information are also on Facebook and also on the YouTube channel.
Fantastic. Well, I will link up to all of those in the show notes. So it's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation with you, Karen, today. I've learned a huge amount, and I'm sure the parents listening will have done as well. But it's also wonderful to see how much we agree on so much stuff, which kind of makes me think I'm going along the right lines.
Yes. It's always good for me to see that, yes, that even in different countries, we're aligned. So this has been good. It's been, you know, part of me doing this book, as I said, you know, I'm a psychologist. I have a PhD. I've always been interested sort of in research. And when I really made it my business to try to connect with the people who are doing this work, learn that research, and to bring that research and to make it accessible. So it's good to hear that this research is resonating with you and with other people. And that's really was my hope in doing this work.
Well, you've definitely done that. And I would highly recommend everyone listening to go and get a copy of The Grit Guide for Teens. So thank you so much for being on the show, Karen. Goodbye.
Now, I thought that interview was absolutely fantastic with Karen. She's so knowledgeable and so experienced. I, as I said in the interview, have read all of the book now that she's written. It's really practical and it's really well thought through and really well laid out. So if you're looking to help your teen to develop more grit, then I'd highly recommend that you get a copy of it. There's a link to it in the show notes, so you can find it easily by doing that. Other than that, I'd just really like to thank you for spending your time with me and Karen today. It's an honour and a privilege that you choose to spend your time with us and that you listen to the things that I have to say. If you do like the show and you've been listening to it over the last few weeks, I'd really appreciate you writing a review on iTunes or in your podcast app. In your podcast app, if you've got an Apple phone, just search for the School Success Formula, and when that comes up, you will see a reviews tab, and that will enable you to write a review straight from your phone, which is really easy and how I like to write reviews for the podcast that I listen to. And then if you'd like to connect with me, or you'd like to give me any other feedback or ask me any questions about the things that you heard in the show, you can connect to me on Twitter at Lucy C. Parsons, or in the private Facebook group for parents, which is the Supportive Parents Successful Students Facebook community. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.